The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on November 6, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Morning. Good to see everybody. Today, I am going to refer to a chapter from a book called Returning to Silence. That's a book written, it's a collaboration of transcribed talks from the teacher Katagiri Roshi, who helped bring Zen to Minnesota. This particular chapter is called San Zen is Zazen. And the title is a little bit misleading because there's a lot of different topics in here, but we definitely get back into the teaching about Zazen, sitting meditation. That will be kind of at the end of the talk. But so I thought I'd just jump right into that. The chapter starts with Katagiri talking about the San Zen and Zazen. He says, San Zen is Zazen. So this San Zen, S-A-N-Z-E-N, is sitting meditation. He says, usually San Zen is translated as practice, but in English, practice doesn't hit the mark of what San Zen is. Literally, San Zen means to surrender ourselves to tranquility or simplicity in life. He says, simplicity is manifested only when our life, our circumstances are very clear. When our life is clear, it is a great opportunity for us to manifest simplicity or tranquility in our life. It is very difficult to manifest simplicity and tranquility in our complicated world. Living in this complicated world, how can we manifest or understand simplicity? He says, this is a difficult matter for us. But we have to do it because it is our original nature. So every day we try to practice in order to submit to tranquility or simplicity in life. We do Zazen, sitting meditation. He says, simplicity is Zazen. So I wanted to give that intro of the chapter there. And part of the reasons why I picked this particular chapter is an experience that happened recently. I thought that this experience and kind of the chapter blend in certain ways. And it was an experience I had about an hour south of here near St. Peter, and we are out walking, enjoying nature, and I looked up and there was, it seems like pretty familiar scene of blackbirds, red-winged blackbirds flying across overhead, pretty close, maybe, I don't know, 100 feet up, but quite a few of them, and they're just kind of blowing across the sky. And then looking a little bit closer, well, I mean, since they were kind of going in a line, I was wondering, you know, where did it start, where it's coming from, so I could kind of see through the trees. And I looked back there, I couldn't quite see where the flock had started, but then through a clearing out in the westerly direction, I could see, well, I kind of followed it, but then it just kept going and going. So those tiny little birds just faded off into kind of a blur where I couldn't see it anymore. And then it became pretty clear that this was like a horizon to horizon line of birds. So what initially started to me is just seeing a small group of red-winged blackbirds. And I think there's some other birds, it turns out, in these types of flocks. But it was a ribbon stretching across the sky. And for me, these examples make me think of the complexity of the natural world, the awe-inspiring numbers of something like that. I was looking at, it was the Cornell Lab of Ornithology to try to get a little bit of understanding of what was going on there. And they say that red-winged blackbird flocks in the winter can add up to a million birds, which is just inconceivable. They say that each morning they spread out and travel over 50 miles to feed. It didn't say how long these strings are of blackbirds, but I mean, if you think of a million birds in a single flock, in a single line, it is absolutely beautiful, eye-opening, and completely mind-boggling to consider what just seemed like a few birds at first. Maybe some of you have seen what's called a murmuration of starlings, I think, mostly. And that's where you have, and it reminds me a little bit of, sometimes you also see videos of small fish that are kind of moving in this kind of fluid, these fluid shapes. And the same thing with starlings. There'll be a real dense black, kind of smaller flock, but then it'll just be undulating. The shapes will be kind of twirling and spinning around. And again, kind of back to my notion of what complexity is, or the idea of complexity. You think about the synchronized movements of these birds, whether it's in a line or in a swirling flock, the tiny little pressure variations. And I think the same thing happens with those fish that are moving like that. They sense like pressure signals from the nearby fish. So they'll sense that, hear it. Same thing with the birds. And that allows them to all move together. So just in a tiny little space is this incredibly complex movement of air molecules, trillions upon trillions of atoms interacting, you know, just in a very small space. And certainly that is the picture of complexity when you think you just spread that over the entire sky or the ocean. And it's kind of, you know, just our way of interpreting that is seeing the complexity of that. But Katagiri is talking about simplicity here. So I wanted to kind of get down to, you know, what is this complexity exactly? Certainly it's very complex. And probably the only reason it's complex is we're trying to explain something of essentially unending detail. So what other outcome do we expect besides complexity when we're trying to explain conceptually what is just inconceivably unending detail, as I say? But really, I think maybe a truer sense of that, and you kind of get that from different fields of science like ecology, that what we're looking at is almost more of an equilibrium rather than a complexity in some ways. So a unity of wholeness or balance, basically, in the natural world. So ultimately, I think in the Buddha Dharma is pointing in this same direction, the teaching of the awakened. Ultimately, experience itself is pointing at an inconceivable simplicity. So that's what Katagiri is trying to get us back to. Our tendency is trying to explain these things in terms of ideas and concepts and so forth. But there's a different way of seeing, a way that is based on experience itself, direct experience. Katagiri goes on and says, Zen Buddhism sees or hears or understands the world and human life is action that is constantly going on. Dogen Zenji, an influential teacher in Zen, in the Zen tradition, says Dogen Zenji particularly mentions that under all circumstances, we should understand the human world in terms of flow process and not in terms of concepts. Category goes on and says, the world is usually, the world we usually see is already something conceptualized. But if the world is present is something other than our conceptualization, we are very confused because there's nothing to depend on. People usually depend consciously or unconsciously on their conceptualizations of the world. The Buddha and the ancestors tried to present the world before conceptualization. It is very difficult to understand, but it is important that we taste it and understand it. The category, again, indicating that we're, I think, looking for something to depend on when we end up trying to make sense of the world through concepts and ideas, framing up what we think is reality. And the study of nature, I think, is an interesting example in that, because it's a way for us to make sense of what's going on. And actually, it's a way, I think, for us to actually find a gateway to protecting and understanding what nature is. So conceptualization allows us to do that. But I think Katagiri here is pointing out, what about experience? I mean, if we are just in this area of trying to find something dependable through conceptualization, we'll be kind of in quite a predicament, basically. So what about this experience, just experience itself? What can we actually say about seeing something in the sky that's just stretching from horizon to horizon? I think there's an impulse to actually not even want to say anything about it. And that's what Katagiri, I think, again, is pointing us to recognize that subtlety, maybe a bit of an insight or impulse not to need to explain that. For the aspect of what Katagiri is talking about with conceptualization, I think of a pretty often cited example of thinking about a waterfall and just getting a better idea of the limits of what our thinking is. And that's, for me, such a great example, because you think of a waterfall as a very distinct thing. You know, maybe it's a famous waterfall somewhere, or you're standing right there and the waterfall is right there. But there's many different questions that come up. You know, the material that makes up that waterfall in just a moment or so is gone. So everything that waterfall was is no more. It's brand new every instant. It's such a striking example of non-enduring selfhood. What is exactly permanent about that thing that we think is there? So, of course, if we're relying on conceptualization, which is based on having ideas of different things, permanent things, the way we explain what we think is going on, that's not going to be very stable, essentially. And then Katagiri says that we depend on things consciously or unconsciously. And maybe in some sense, we'll think of that thing is the waterfall, but then we'll think, well, maybe it's not exactly a waterfall. It doesn't, you know, what exactly is there? And almost without even verbalizing anything to ourselves, there'll be this, since we depend on the concepts, there'll be an uneasiness that comes up. So we'll think, well, is there no waterfall then? Is it non-existent? And again, I think this, maybe as Kategori said, is almost like an unconscious reaction when we feel that something is shaking that foundation of our concepts of what we think reality is. It can be a little uneasy. Because we, again, are sort of depending on that. But in respect to recognizing just experience, I think we can slow down a bit. And again, just with the direct knowledge that experience is not changing, no matter what we think of what the waterfall is, we can just set that down, basically not insist that it be a waterfall or that the waterfall doesn't exist. Coming back to experience is what Kategori, I think, is helping us do. So this is about not being bothered by the different labels, the different kind of dependency that we have on explaining things, and just return to the simplicity of experience itself. As Kategori was saying, that this tradition is trying to present seeing the world before conceptualization. And I think thinking and thoughts and inclinations can be pretty strong sometimes, so it's hard to imagine exactly what that would be like. Just to set down our ideas. And for some reason, the kind of the image of something maybe I had thought of as important or had a strong idea about or was really drawn towards, maybe you think about the music you listened to as a kid and you really wanted this one album, or maybe there was some sort of event that you really wanted to go to. And now as I reflect back on that, you know, I just don't have maybe any interest in that album anymore. So it's maybe a little bit like that, a window into just setting something down. You can see that notion of maybe having that album, but it's possible to actually just let that be, or to not, you know, it's possible that that magnetic kind of element of thinking doesn't have to be there. And you can imagine that in something that no longer interests you. So you might go out and see your car that's underneath the tree. I remember there's robins that landed out on these front trees here, and any cars that were underneath were had basically a new paint job, if you catch my drift. So going out there, maybe you just wash your car the day before. That could be like, you know, somewhat disturbing, or however you describe it. But I think it is possible to, when we come back and really let experience inform the activity of our life, we can see something like that and not be thrown as much. Like being tossed about is not really helping to resolve maybe we need another car wash or whatever the solution might be. We can actually just set that down and be okay with the moment, see a bigger picture. Our reaction is not holding the bigger view in mind. So like the notion, so what's the solution? We get rid of birds? You know, it's like it doesn't make any sense basically having more panoramic understanding of our life, I think, really helps tone down that charge that can often go along with thinking. Kategori goes on and says, he brings up another example. Says another example, is the relationship between a piece of paper and fire. If you burn the paper, you may say, paper is something other than the fire in terms of the world of conceptualization. It is very clear. You can see the existence of the paper as separate from the fire, but actually, what do you mean by burning the paper? In terms of an active understanding, active penetration, flow process between fire and paper, in other words, in terms of true reality of paper and fire, you cannot separate them because paper is fire, fire is paper. You almost see it in that example of the birds. So if we take birds out of the picture, you can easily see that other problems are arising. You know, mosquito population explode, whatever example you want to bring up. So Katagiri is asking, what exactly do we mean by the burning of paper? And there's just so many different ways of finding paradox and limitations to conceptualization. Is the fire itself different from burning paper? Or is the fire like a waterfall? You know, what is permanent about fire itself? What, in what sense is that a permanent thing unto itself? And I would say that when we go down that road, when we try to really come up with a strong explanation, it's just too much, basically. It's too much for conceptualization to handle. So we're asking concepts to deliver absolute truth, to have an absolute notion of what fire is, what paper is, what burning paper is, all of that. Is it's kind of like, you know, asking conceptualization to deliver absolute truth to us is like asking a candle, you know, a single candle to heat our entire home in the winter. It's just too much. It does not work. And it's inevitable frustration. So this isn't about getting rid of conceptualization. It's just recognizing that absolute truth is never going to be delivered by turning the gears and coming up with explanations. And with experience, with this scenery of what our life is, the scenery of the blackbirds shows up. Also, the scenery of thinking shows up too. And, so I guess what I'm trying to say is thinking can come up. We can use that provisionally, but there's no need to come to some strong conclusions about conceptualization. So, what do we do about it? I think what we can do is just be okay with thinking and concepts. Essentially, just let it be when it's coming up. Certainly, you sit down in meditation sometimes and thinking is just wildly running all over the place and your mind's jumping from this topic to that topic. And I would say that there's nothing wrong with that at all. We can just let that be as it is. If it's just a certain energy that seems to be happening, that's perfectly fine. If we happen to think that conceptualization is something that is undesirable or that we want to somehow transform or we want meditation to create something different, that I think is really just to reify the thinking itself, to make that kind of into its own permanent entity that we want to extract from experience, which is all just kind of a fantasy in a way. Kategiri brings up a koan, an interaction between a Zen master and his disciple. And just to give you a basic overview, the teacher, the Zen master asks, or he tells the disciple that there's, let me see here. He asks, do you know that there are two moons? And the disciple says, is just doesn't understand what the teacher is saying, basically. And Kategiri uses that in this chapter. He is looking at the disciple and this disciple's apparent understanding that, and I think a pretty common understanding that we think the moon, there's one moon. It's the moon out there, up, you know, in space near Earth. But the Zen master is saying that that's not everything. So that one moon is our tendency to, you know, that's our idea, the moon, that one thing. But the Zen master's saying that's not the whole picture. Kategiri says, in the world of the truth, something is always happening. Something is always going on. So he's talking about reality before conceptualization and talking about truth here. I looked up the etymology of truth, and there's an interesting word. It derives from an earlier notion of constancy, which we hear Kategiri saying something always happening, something always going on, this synonymous nature of truth and constancy, this experience of here now experience, this unitary experience, constant, always here now experience. What is truly unequivocal and completely unmistakable. I mean, you think about trust. What is totally beyond question? You can always trust that this experience is always here and now. You'll never find yourself in the past or the future. I mean, you'll find yourself here now thinking about those things, but it's always here and now. Kategiri talks about sitting a little bit in the end, so we get back to that intro of the chapter where he's talking about Sanzen and Zazen. Again, Zazen being meditation, essentially, practice, or more subtly, as Kategiri was saying, the surrendering ourselves to the tranquility and simplicity in life. So you'll come across that in Zen teachings a bit, that meditation will be spoken about in a practical way where we can understand what sitting practice is, you know, the posture, the very important and crucial things to know about meditation. And then also you get like Kategiri talking about Zazen, Sanzen is not being just practice, or the, you know, even when we're talking about the practical things, what we're actually talking is about, what we're talking about is surrendering ourselves to our being this tranquility, our simplicity. So you get a, in some ways, a less conceptual idea of what meditation is or mindfulness, because what could even about that, you know, what can we say about that? There's nothing to really land on there. To understand the essence of sitting is just to sit. There's, you know, I'm talking about it right now, but I guess that's what my point is. To really understand these things is just to experience them. Kategiri says, this story, the one about the Zen master and the student. He says, the story reminds me of the meaning of Zazen. That is casting off body and mind. So let me read that. The story reminds me of the meaning of Zazen. That is casting off body and mind. If you sit down, that is simultaneously casting off body and mind, dropping off body and mind, being free of body and mind. So here, definitely, when I read this, I'm hearing something that conceptually, it's hard to like pick up on what he's saying here. So it's a teaching, I think, that is expressing almost an experiential quality to it already, just in reading it. He says, if you sit down, immediately your body and mind are cast off. He says, we don't believe it, but it is true. Actually true, completely true. So what does that mean? It means, I think, that just sitting down is not anything at all. We think of meditation, I think, in many different ways. We think of it as maybe something that I'll fit into my schedule. And I think all these things have a truth to them. We'll think of it as a meditation is kind of different than my usual activities, or we'll maybe think of it as potentially having an effect on our life. Some sort of outcome may come about. But at a minimum, we think of it as a thing. But when we read what Katagiri is saying here, when we sit down, body and mind are cast off. So that, I think, means that to set down any idea of what meditation is, anything in life, experience itself, there's nothing that can be added or clarified by trying to explain what it is. And Katagiri says, when you sit down in Zazen, you don't know why. I mean, when you really sit down, you can come up with an idea, but I mean, what idea is going to like answer that question, why you're sitting, why anything's happening? I mean, you can come up with a lot of things, but sitting, the experience is what he's saying. He goes on and says, if you think about it, you can come up with many reasons, but the reasons don't hit the mark exactly. You cannot ignore the reasons you have thought of because they are part of the truth. I'll reread that, sorry. You cannot ignore the reasons you have thought of because they are part of the truth, but they're not the complete truth. So all those different reasons maybe that we think we're going to fit it into our schedule, which is something that we need to consider, how it will fit into our schedule, or different things to consider. But he says that's not the full truth of what Zazen sitting meditation is. So all of these are fine, you know, all these different ways of explaining, or even you may see like research that says meditation leads to certain outcomes, like health outcomes and so forth. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. I mean, that's great if that happens. But I think the important part here is when that is the emphasis of what we think it is or why we're doing it, that is not a meditative mind. That's a mind that's thinking about something else. It's about thinking about outcomes and so forth. And that's not bad either. The thing is that we're just particularly not bad at spotting when we're thinking about getting something else or making something, a meditation into something. So all this is about is just recognizing when we make anything into something, make meditation into a tool to obtain something. Because ultimately, it is not that what we're talking about. Meditation is actually just being and fully living. So being present and aware, not only in formal sitting meditation, but in any aspect of our life. This kind of ability to spot things. I was reading a book, The Education of Little Tree, I think it is, and it tells a story of a Native American grandfather and grandmother who are raising a grandchild. And there's some stories in there where the grandfather is watching the activity kind of the settlers and other people from kind of off on the side, and he's never noticed. So he's always been, you know, never detected, even like when he's observing animals and so forth, this native grandfather. So it's just kind of like an image of the same thing where we don't take the time a lot of the time to really just see what's happening in this moment. We're kind of like, we're not noticing the whole picture. We're just kind of caught up in whatever we're doing, but we actually can slow down and come back to this moment, pay attention to what is happening. And again, in any type of situation in our life. And that's kind of the image I got from that book, is somebody who was very attentive to the point where other people couldn't even see that he was there. He was just so blended into the environment. It was just seeing what was going on. And there's some pretty humorous situations there where he kind of just let things happen. People kind of mumbling over themselves. But the point is, we can bring that attention and attentiveness to our lives as well and blend in to this experience. Kategori says, what you want is to be present right here in the middle of true reality, where you and Zazen exactly merge, nothing else. If you sit down, you feel something, you can taste it. Let's see here. I'll read a little bit more. He says, by virtue of deeply seeing the human world or hearing the sounds of the world, immediately we manifest ourselves with wholeheartedness. This is the meaning of with all their mind, or with all your mind. He says, this is called faith. This is called emptiness. So you may have heard that term in Buddhism before, emptiness. He says, if you penetrate gradually and deeply into Zen practice again and again, it moves very slowly in your mind, into your mind, into your life. It sneaks in, invades your life very slowly. So he covers a few things here. He talks again about emptiness, faith, and a sort of wholeheartedness, he says, with all your mind. All those things together. So normally emptiness is spoken about in terms of understanding that there's no persistent nature to anything in experience, which I think in its deepest essence is just saying that reality is as it is. There's nothing solidified about it. So the truth of reality is essentially the truth of emptiness, that nothing, there's no fragmentation, no like interaction and collision and valuation. All those things are not the true nature of what actually is going on. And he brings those together in this paragraph here. He says, practicing, basically, let's see, gradually and deeply, you practice this Zen way again and again, he says. It moves very slowly into your mind, into your life. It sneaks in and invades your life very slowly. And I don't think it's anything that we can particularly try to control or do anything extra. Obviously, there's no shortcuts into seeing reality as it is, just experiencing. I used to give guitar lessons way back, and I know one challenge for people learning it is to get your left and your right hand to go at the same time. So you'll play the fret with one finger and then you'll use the pick to play the note. And it's, I know it can be pretty frustrating because they just aren't, probably like playing drums or whatever, you know, it's just like they're not going together. But it's an interesting thing. It's almost like you can't try to do it. All you can do is just like really pay attention and listen when those things are not happening. And I think it is an example of this again and again, the category talks about. So the practice is not like, if I can just force myself to do this, you know, then I can bring the elements together. But really it's just a slow, continual process of really paying attention. And just through that attention itself, this thing will happen, you know, this, you know, how to say it for the guitar playing, you know, just, I think it very naturally comes together. But in terms of practice, is maybe more of an understanding that we can just completely set aside the ideas of trying to control or worry about any type of changing anything, and just really focus on attentiveness itself, again and again, coming back to attentiveness. So Katagiri talks about the constancy in life. That first sentence, sanzen, is to surrender ourselves to tranquility or simplicity in life. Or this just going on that he mentions in several points in the chapter, this constancy is to continually collect our mind. And for me, that just again and again, coming back, collecting the mind, I don't think you could think of anything more simple than what that is. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that we could make things more complex by, you know, adding techniques or making certain valuations about what practice is, but the essence of what Katagiri is getting at here, the simplicity, surrendering to that, is just coming back. Keep it as simple as possible. So by just staying here, we can be that activity of simplicity itself, that activity that is already going on, constantly going on. I think that's pretty much everything I have. Ended a little bit earlier than I thought I would, but definitely wanted to open it up for questions, any thoughts or observations that you may have had. or anything at all. It's a pretty interesting chapter for sure. Yeah, Matt.
Yeah,
we'll get you the microphone so Zoom folks can listen in.
Yeah, I've been pretty anxious for a while now because I thought I wanted to say something or share something for a while. So, and that's been what probably the biggest part of this, you know, Zen practice has been for me, dealing with painful, difficult, troubling feelings, moods, emotions, all that kind of stuff. I'm the kind of person who spent much of my life trying to, you know, numb those feelings out and that kind of thing. So this practice has been real helpful for me that way. But I just, there was a couple points in your talk where I could make a solid connection when you said to be okay with thinking. And then also that the words truth and constancy are related somehow. I went with my brother to Duluth on Tuesday this past week. And we both had some time off of work over that. And we're walking along the shore of Duluth. And I heard a great Dharma talk recently that really made me think of it. Someone in the person giving the Dharma talk said, you wouldn't, she was talking about Shinryu Suzuki's mind weeds, or mind waves talk in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, and that you wouldn't stand in front of a lake or the ocean, ask it to stop making waves. And to me, that was such a great metaphor because that seems to be what I want my thinking mind to do. Once I start, you know, I start obsessing, I start having troubling thoughts and they create difficult, frustrating emotions or whatever the, and I, you know, often, I mean, it's always, pretty much always the case where, right, you're not being, you know, stabbed with knives. You're not, you know, in the back alley at night being hunted by or anything like that. It's, you know, like, you know, give it a couple minutes. Like just, you know, we got all my body's senses to come back to. And that's where the, you know, the reality or the truth and constancy is always going on. It's just so my tendency to get lost when I distract myself from it somehow, this just ability to stay present. And it's really, really, so difficult at times when I get so wrapped up in my thinking. Becoming more so familiar with Zazen helps me to just realize I've got like the present moment is never not there. I've got my whole body and my senses to always come back to ground myself here now and really understand there's that whole wanting, this tendency to want to understand. I mean, if it seems like it's always wanting to understand something is behind all these troubling thoughts, is it, I don't even know, or protecting and defending my personality, my ego, wanting to not upset people so badly or whatever, thinking like I've always done something wrong when it's really usually really unnecessary. I guess it's all, you know, my ego or my, you know, worrying about how I appear to other people and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's really just like you said, the truth and constancy to just be able to just come back to just here I am. I'm sitting in the chair, I can feel myself in the chair, I can feel my feet on the floor. I can, you know, listen to myself breathe, I can feel my fingers rub together. And that's all it takes to just bring peace right away. It's just kind of this endless process of getting more familiar with that. And that, at least I think I can say that's what I've learned with definitely not being some kind of expert at it or some kind of teacher or anything like that. It's just as a student that not only as this has helped me a lot so far, and I don't expect the learning to ever stop, but yeah, I just wanted to say that and share that. And yeah, thank you for the talk.
Thanks. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, you make a lot of great points there. And for sure, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki. I don't know how many times in there he says, don't be bothered by thinking. or there's a chapter, Be Kind With Yourself. Many parallels to what you're talking about there. And just settling in this moment, I think, is the great opportunity to be kind with ourselves. And I don't know, yeah, who knows all the different reasons why we kind of think about things, or why we're sort of drawn to that, like you say, the really elemental things about protecting ourselves or presenting ourselves in a certain way. But what Katagiri is getting at here is a type of stability, like you say, truth in the constancy of this moment, and knowing that we can really trust that. I don't know, there's so many things that happen in life where, you know, I can think of examples where I just kind of maybe almost inadvertently try to paint over different things that are going on. But I think there is the opportunity to really take care of ourselves, take care of other people. And I just don't see how in attentiveness would hinder that. In other words, attentiveness, I think, is the way to really understand taking our care of ourselves and others, and to see when we may be kind of, you know, just wanting things to change, wanting or having problems with different things. I should say that recognizing different things, you know, there may be helpful ways of sort of looking at how we, you know, our different activity and behavior that may be helpful for us. But the core of what's being talked about here is just this attentiveness. And I think that can really help clear up so many confusions that we get caught up in. So yeah, thanks for all those comments. Very helpful.
In my persona as a human being, I loved your talk. And part of what you're saying touches on an inescapable but distracting part of my thinking. When I get into an operational mode of thinking, I think I have to have an effect. You know, if someone's sick, I have to do something, or I have to go to the grocery store or the drugstore or something. Part of that is fed by a sense of responsibility. You know, I'm responsible for this. But even then, once you get in that mode, then you can slip into an operational view of trivial things and become absorbed in them too. Can you say something more about that operational wanting to have an effect of whatever? How to set it down when it's taken over your mind?
Yeah, for sure. That's a great question. And I think it's an inevitability that we'll never probably know. We'll never be able to make a perfect distinction between what we think is sort of appropriate practical things and then like the frivolous stuff. And I think from the point of Buddha Dharma, it's not asking us to make a delineation, but I think your point is very important to always try to keep an eye on that. You know, it's just part of our responsibility, I think, is to try to act in an upright way as much as we can. But the Buddha Dharma here is talking about really paying attention to what we're doing. And what that is to notice when our mind is leaning. And that will probably be a pretty good gauge for what's frivolous and what's sort of on the other side, where we're just sincerely trying to do our best in a practical way, negotiating the relative world. Again, deciphering that gradient is not really, you know, we can think about things like that, but the Buddha Dharma is just attentiveness to the leaning of mind that comes up. And from there, it's not even about trying to move the needle across that gradient back into, you know, what we think is better or something like that. The attentiveness, I think, is in itself the functioning of allowing that appropriate behavior to sort of have a chance of arising, or compassion. So it's not trying to be something or trying to identify what's good and going after that. It's watching closely, moment by moment, our activity. And it's not about getting rid of frivolous. It's not about any prescribed action at all. Just paying attention. I think we can maybe think of wisdom as just clarifying, you know, just the clarification of its own accord that happens. And I don't know, for me, if wisdom is manifesting, I think we could say that compassion will be right there with it. Appropriate behavior, really watching where we may be slipping up, and not scolding ourselves, but, you know, try to make corrective actions without judging ourselves or others. That quite gets to what you're saying, but that's at least how I heard your question. Is a very interesting one.
So really, it's much more fundamental to be attentive. If you want to be responsible, that could just be a preconception. You could be, have some foregone conclusion implicit in that idea of responsibility, and that could be a distraction. But if you're just paying attention, you're probably more likely to be responsible. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Particularly when you think about different cultures or different ways that people live their life. Some groups may think that one thing is better, and, you know, just like all kinds of different views, basically. So the attentiveness, I think, is, you know, what we're talking about here, watching the leaning of mind. That's really, and it's also very simple practice to just paying attention to what we're doing without the need of deciding good and bad and everything else. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter. But thanks, everybody. Good to see you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.